Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-1197, Haji Bismillah, also known as Haji Bismillah, also known as Haji Bismillah, and Muhammad Wali, next friend of Haji Bismillah, petitioners versus Robert M. Gates, Secretary of Defense. Case number 07-1508, Abdusabor, petitioner versus Robert M. Gates, U.S. Secretary of Defense et al. Case number 07-1523, Hamad, petitioner versus Robert M. Gates, Secretary of Defense et al. Mr. Katsis for the respondents, Ms. Cowan for the petitioners.
Good morning. May it please the court. In both the Detainee Treatment Act and the Military Commissions Act, Congress intended to replace habeas corpus review with an alternative review scheme that would be narrower than habeas corpus, that would channel judicial review exclusively to this court, and that would function as a constitutionally adequate substitute for habeas. Now that Boumediene has invalidated the habeas strip in the Military Commissions Act, the question presented is whether the narrower and exclusive habeas substitute can continue to function as Congress intended. The answer to that question is no. The intended effect of the exclusive review scheme is apparent, we think, from the structure of the relevant statutes, both the DTA and the MCA, and certainly from the legislative history of both the DTA and the MCA.
Your point is that it cannot function, the DTA review scheme?
It cannot function as Congress intended, Judge Ginsburg, as a narrower and exclusive alternative to habeas. Under severability doctrine, of course, the easy case is one in which the remainder provision simply can't function at all. But that is a sufficient ground for holding a remainder not severable. It's not a necessary ground. And as the court made clear in Booker, a provision can be non-severable either because it simply can't function at all or because, as here, it can't function in the manner that Congress intended, as a narrower, exclusive alternative to habeas, rather than as judicial review parallel to and above and beyond habeas.
Seems like an odd way of putting it, frankly. Why isn't it more direct simply to say, and maybe this is what you're going to say, that it is not, it was not intended to coexist with habeas, but as an alternative.
I'm sorry if I'm not clear. That I think was what I was intending to say.
What do you make of the Supreme Court's view in both Boumediene and Hamden as to the coexistence of the two statutory schemes?
With respect to Hamden first, and then I'll come to Boumediene. The court did say. The court did construe the DTA to permit habeas review prior to the time of a final military commission judgment or CSIRT decision. It didn't address whether there could be parallel tracks after a final decision, Judge Rogers. But more importantly, the conception of the DTA scheme that the Hamden court adopted was emphatically rejected by Congress in Section 7 of the Military Commission Act, and Boumediene itself emphasized that Congress's intent in the MCA was to overrule the jurisdictional holding of Hamden, and Boumediene at page 2266 of the Supreme Court opinion actually went back, revisited the question of Congress's intent in the DTA, and recharacterized the intent of the DTA as one to take a pending set of habeas cases and replace them with an exclusive review scheme in this court. So the aspect of Hamdan that you're talking about, we think, has been superseded by Boumediene. Now, with respect to your question about Boumediene, it is true, Boumediene says that the CCERT scheme and the DTA review following the CCERT scheme survive its holding. But keep in mind, that is in a context where, number one, no party briefed severability.
I'm not thinking of that particular point.
Okay.
I'm thinking of the point where it discusses as a matter of when habeas kicks in as distinct from when the review of a CSRT kicks in, where it says, if I remember correctly, I think it's a 2275 or 76, about giving the executive sufficient time.
On the exhaustion and abstention, the prudential doctrines? Well, it's again, the critical point for our purposes with respect to jurisdiction is that severability wasn't raised, and I'll come back to that in a second. You are right that, if I'm right that severability wasn't raised, the consequence of the Boumediene holding is habeas review is available because the strip was struck, and DTA review survives because the court held that it wasn't independently unconstitutional and the severability question hadn't been presented to it. The court then went on to address, on all of those assumptions, there would be parallel jurisdictional tracks, one under habeas, one under the DTA/MCA, and then the question would be whether any prudential judge-made doctrines would support sequencing rules, holding off habeas review pending DTA review. In Bisardi, this court suggested an alternative of holding off DTA review pending habeas. But the point of all of that is that all of that analysis of prudential sequencing rules presupposes that there are two existing jurisdictional bases. That is a question that was not presented in Boumediene, is presented here, and we think if you just ask the straightforward severability question, would Congress have intended DTA review to function not as a narrow or an exclusive substitute for habeas, but as an alternative, additional complement to habeas, whether simultaneous or sequenced, we think the answer to that question is no.
Let me approach it from a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Before 9/11, if someone had been taken into custody in a time of war,
mm-hmm.
and that person had been designated prisoner of war,
yeah.
Regulation 190-8 would have applied. And
in a conflict covered by the Geneva Conventions, correct?
That's right. I'm talking about post-Geneva.
Right.
And under that scheme, is it not correct that while there are a series of internal military, Defense Department military reviews, there is also judicial review, albeit by an Article I court. Sorry to be so long-winded.
No, I understand.
What I'm trying to get at is that because, as a result of the War on Terror, a decision was made not to designate the detainees prisoners of war, there was no procedure until Secretary England's delegation set up this procedure.
Right.
So Congress, when it looks at these, sort of the state of the world, knows that there have always been two procedures. There's been the prisoner of war up through the Military Court of Appeals and on beyond that, and then there's also been habeas.
Well,
so wouldn't it be odd, or would it, for Congress to say we're going to change the scheme as dramatically as you're suggesting?
Let's start with 190-8 in the pre-9/11 world in your hypothetical. I think the question of judicial review would depend in part on whether the detainee was an alien or a citizen, whether the detainee was held in this country.
My only point was there was a scheme in existence.
There was an administrative scheme. Right. There would have been a litigable issue about judicial review along the lines of the way Rasool was litigated. I think we would take the position that if a detainee were held as a prisoner of war, let's say near an active field of battle, there would not be judicial review. And keep in mind, the United States held 2 million prisoners of war in World War II, and there were virtually no habeas petitions. So we would sort of relitigate the question of the scope of the original habeas statute as applied to aliens held outside the country.
I suppose my question just goes to there was a scheme, not that aspects of it wouldn't be litigated. Whereas for the detainees, there was no scheme.
There was an administrative scheme. And let's assume, let me assume the worst case from my perspective, which is that the government would lose on the question whether Rasool extended the original habeas statute worldwide. So let's assume the habeas statute extends worldwide to aliens pre-DTA. What follows from that? What follows from that is there would be an administrative review. There would be administrative review through the 190-8 tribunals, followed by one bite at the apple of judicial review through habeas corpus. And then,
that isn't true. That's all I'm trying to establish here, that you could get ultimately up to the Military Court of Appeals.
I'm sorry, for a military commission trial or a status determination?
Some type of, there was an avenue. That's what I'm trying to get at. In other words, if I were a person in Congress, I would say, well, there is a scheme out there. Whether a particular prisoner of war can avail himself of it remains to be determined.
There's an administrative scheme, and then there may be a litigable question about whether the habeas statute applies. But what there emphatically is not, as a matter of history, is an administrative scheme followed by parallel, duplicative schemes of review, including both habeas and an exclusive review scheme in a court of appeals.
The scope of review under the detainee treatment
is narrower.
Yeah, they're not duplicative.
Well, it's duplicative. It's duplicative in the sense that under the DTA, both the habeas strip and the exclusive review scheme governed the same class of claims, detention challenges by aliens held by the Defense Department at Guantanamo, as amended by the Military Commissions Act. The habeas strip and the exclusive review scheme govern the same broadened category of claims, namely detention claims by aliens held by any U.S. agency as enemy combatants anywhere. So duplicative in the sense that it covers the same class of claims. You're absolutely right, Judge Rogers, that the exclusive review scheme is narrower in the way you describe, but that's simply an aspect of Congress's manifested intent to give detainees less review than had been available under the habeas baseline. And that underscores, in our view, the implausibility for severability purposes of now transmogrifying Congress's intent to give detainees something less than habeas into a scheme where they now get something more than habeas.
Let me ask you, if the CSRT regime had never been established,
right,
and there was no habeas, what was there?
No CSRT and... Well, I'm just trying to understand the hypothetical. There was always a habeas statute, and there's always the suspension clause. No, so
your response to me in part about 190-8 is right. You would argue that certain aliens don't have certain rights under that scheme, et cetera. So my hypothetical is there's no CSRT, there's no habeas.
Right.
What is there?
Well, the alien... if there's no...
In other words, I'm just trying to understand here. I thought it was the administration's position that there needed to be some mechanism available.
For judicial review?
Yes, and originally its position was that habeas was not available.
Originally, I mean...
Historically, it took the position habeas was not available to these types of...
Correct. We took the broad position that the suspension clause doesn't apply to aliens held outside the country with no significant voluntary contacts to the country. Of course, had that position prevailed, it would, by definition, be permissible for Congress to cut off all judicial review. We didn't prevail on that position. We now know... There has to be some avenue for judicial review, but I guess I'm still struggling with your hypothetical. Any alien could always have raised claims that the habeas statute and or the suspension clause governs his situation. Such aliens would have had administrative review, as you point out, probably under Article 190-8. Before the CSRT came into existence, there were other...
Only if they were prisoners of war.
Under 190-8, unlawful combatants in this war had... screening mechanisms less formal than CSRTs before 2004.
But that was always unclear, wasn't it? I mean, the Attorney General gave a speech and we learned about some of these reviews, but part of the MCA was to establish standards for these.
Mm-hmm. For trials. But the point is, any way you look at the history, Judge Rogers, there may have been debates about the extent of administrative process, military process that was appropriate, and there may have been debates about the scope of statutory habeas or constitutional habeas, but what there never was an alternative exclusive review scheme in the Court of Appeals functioning above and beyond habeas on a parallel track. And the question before you today...
In an Article III court.
Correct. And the question before you today is simply whether Congress intended to create that scheme, administrative review plus habeas plus something else.
No Article I review.
Beyond habeas. Remember, post-Boumediene, every alien will get constitutionally sufficient judicial review through habeas. The only question is whether Congress intended to provide aliens held outside the country as enemy combatants with even more than habeas. And the statutory structure, we think, makes clear the answer is no. The legislative history, if you look at the floor statements of the Military Commissions Act on what Congress was trying to accomplish. This court considered them in Boumediene. The Supreme Court on review said this court was correct to consider those floor statements in in figuring out what the MCA was doing. Those floor statements just...
Do we look at a later Congress to determine what a previous Congress had in mind?
You look at existing law. The intent of Congress is manifested both in DTA legislative history and in MCA legislative history. The MCA legislative history that the Supreme Court in Boumediene said was properly consulted establishes that the intent of Congress in the MCA, and I'll quote you one snippet here, was to substitute what Senator Cornyn described as a blizzard of habeas with narrower D.C. Circuit only review. So the question is,
the court rejected that, didn't it?
I mean, no, not as a,
there are ways to accommodate, quote, the blizzard.
Not as a statutory matter. The Supreme Court upheld this court's view of the statute that the MCA was designed precisely to overrule the jurisdictional holding of Hamdan, make the habeas strip immediately effective to pending cases, and thus complete Congress's intended objective of effecting the substitute of habeas litigation for DTA litigation in this court.
So, just so I'm clear, is your position then, because the legislative history says that the DTA and the MCA were substitutes for habeas,
were narrower alternatives to habeas, were designed as an exclusive scheme, and were substitutes. All of that. Okay.
Is it your position that Congress intended the DTA and the MCA to be substitutes for habeas relief?
Yes.
That therefore it would follow that since habeas relief is available, the other two statutes fall by the wayside?
The short answer is yes, but let me just be clear. What?
There is no CSRT left.
No, but let me...
No. See, that's what I'm trying to be very clear about.
Well, let me be very clear about my answer to your question. The portion of the DTA, the portions of the DTA and MCA that we think are not severable from the jurisdiction strip are the judicial review provisions.
I understand.
Which are...
You want the court to sort of rewrite that statute.
No, we're not asking for the court to
If it's a substitute, it's a substitute, so it all goes.
What we're asking you to do is apply the inquiry that the Supreme Court has said time and again is mandated for severability purposes, which is to ask yourself the following question. If Congress knew that one provision of a statute is unconstitutional, would it have preferred the residue, or would it have preferred nothing at all? With respect to the judicial review provisions of the DTA and MCA, not any other provisions of those statutes, the judicial review provisions, which cover the same claims that could be brought through habeas, are narrower, intended as an alternative and as a substitute. Would Congress prefer habeas-only review or alternative review both through habeas and through this court? Congress intended to give the detainees something less than habeas. It is more consistent with Congress's intent to leave the detainees with the constitutionally mandated option of habeas than to give them something more than habeas. Whatever Congress was trying to accomplish, it was not to expand the opportunities for detainees to litigate in court.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Katsas. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. 4 months after the Boumediene decision and more than six years after my client Haji Bismillah was detained, the government is claiming for the very first time, and contrary to its prior representations to this court and to Congress, that this court has no subject matter jurisdiction to consider Mr. Bismillah's claim or any other claim by a detainee at Guantanamo, because on the theory that a provision of the DTA enacted in 2005 is inseparable from a provision of the MCA, which was enacted in 2006. The government is wrong for two reasons. First, the Supreme Court in Boumediene and another panel of this court in Parhat have both ruled that both DTA and habeas review is available to detainees, and those decisions are binding precedent. Second, the Supreme Court's severability analysis compels the conclusion that the provision in DTA allowing this court to review claims by detainees is severable from the habeas jurisdiction strip. In particular, the retention of subject matter jurisdiction is more consistent with Congress's basic objectives in enacting the DTA, and therefore the statute is severable. The Supreme Court was clear in Boumediene that a cause of action under the DTA survives the decision. It said explicitly that the DTA process survives intact, and that was the basis for an extensive discussion both about the exhaustion requirement and about the interaction of the CSRT process and the DTA. So although this...
It's not clear to me what we're supposed to make of that. Obviously, the court did say that. Mr. Katsas makes the point that the issue wasn't before them about severability. They had no reason to assume anything other than the continued viability or validity of the statute.
Well, I think, right? Although it is dictum, it's clearly carefully considered dictum. It's not a throwaway line in the opinion. The court delves into the question of the DTA process at some length. And since it was carefully considered under U.S. v. Dorsley, I believe it's...
It is carefully considered. We presume that everything they say is carefully considered, despite the evidence sometimes, of which there's none here. But it's nonetheless literally true, isn't it, that if they decide only the one issue, the other statute remains intact unless and until it's ever put before them.
That is correct.
So there's reason to, or they had their own reasons for going out and discussing that, and no reason to advert to the possibility that it would be held invalid.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
So they had their own reasons for going on to discuss it, and no reason to advert to the mere possibility, if it even occurred to them, that it might later be challenged and held invalid.
Well, I think that this court, now considering the severability analysis, needs to consider whether it is evident that the two provisions were meant to stand or fall together.
Well, in Bassard, another panel of the court looked more fleetingly at that question. I mean, they weren't resolving it. There was a PI question. And there's the sequence of events is suggestive, isn't it? That the Congress was responding to the prior, when it passed the MCA, that was responding to the Supreme Court's decision in a way intended to, so it seemed, provide narrow and centralized review.
Well, keep in mind that the cause of action, the provision that is under consideration now, is not in the MCA. It's in the DTA. And so the question is whether or not Congress, in enacting the DTA, intended for that provision that created a cause of action to stand or fall with the strip of habeas jurisdiction. And if that was Congress's intent, they certainly could have been explicit about it. As opposed to many...
Well, they could have been, and sometimes they'll have a non-severability provision in a statute. But the absence of such a provision hasn't been deemed significant.
That is true, though this is rather unique circumstances, as opposed to a situation in which the unconstitutionality of a provision is only discovered years after enactment. For the DTA, the unconstitutionality of the habeas strip was the legislative debate. Congress was clearly on notice that there was a possibility that their habeas strip was going to be struck down. And so had they intended for these two provisions to go together, they could have indicated that. Another indication of that was not the case is the DTA specifies where the habeas strip is to be codified. It says it will be codified at 28 U.S.C. 2241. It does not specify where the cause of action is. And Alaska, under Alaska Airlines, looking at the text of the statute is one way to interpret whether or not Congress intended it to be severable. And in fact, the cause of action with the rest of the DTA is codified someplace else. I think also part of this court's analysis must be a consideration of why Congress, if it wanted to substitute DTA review for habeas, rather than just looking at the form, which has clearly been struck down by the Supreme Court. The question is, what were the substantive benefits that Congress believed would occur if it could substitute DTA review for habeas review? And if, in fact, if you look at those benefits, if you look at Congress's basic objectives in passing the DTA, you'll find that retention of jurisdiction by this court is more consistent with Congress's basic objectives than rejecting the cause of action. So if we go through the list, the first one, one of the things that Mr. Katz has mentioned was a blizzard of litigation. He hasn't presented any evidence that retaining jurisdiction will result in a blizzard of litigation, just on a pure numerical basis. At the time the DTA was passed, there were 500 detainees at Guantanamo. There are now 250. So even if every single detainee at Guantanamo filed both a DTA claim and a habeas claim, that would still be the same number of actions that Congress felt was appropriate when it enacted the DTA. And putting aside numbers, if you look at the course of the habeas litigation and the DTA litigation is certainly not clear. There have been, this panel knows well, there have been a number of delays in both sets of litigation. So rather, retaining jurisdiction does not result in a blizzard of litigation. What it more likely would result in is detainees as expeditiously as possible having their day before an independent decision maker, which is consistent both with Congress's objective in having a streamlined review process and with the Supreme Court's admonition in Boumediene that the costs of delay shall no longer be borne by those in custody.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, part of the argument that the government made going back away was that first the DTA and then later the MCA were the same as Army Regulation 190-8. In other words, virtually all the rights that a prisoner of war would have under 190-8, a Guantanamo detainee would have under the DTA. So then we have all this, we want to call it what, snippets of legislative history about substitute. And then we have the Supreme Court using the word substitute. So under the Alaska Airlines analysis, exactly then what is the duty of this court?
The duty of this court under the Alaska Airlines analysis, or the Booker analysis more recently, it's quite clear that the statute will not survive exactly as Congress intended. And the duty of this court is to excise as little of the statute as possible to have it remain in operation consistent with Congress's basic objectives. I think the first two parts of the Booker analysis are not in debate here. There's no question that the provision is constitutionally sound as long as it's not held out as an adequate for substitute for habeas, and there's no question that it can operate independently. This court's ability to hear claims is in no way dependent on whether or not the district court can also hear habeas claims. And so to answer your question, Judge Rogers, I think that the duty of this court is to look at why Congress enacted the judicial review provisions in the DTA and consider whether retention of jurisdiction is more consistent with those objectives than striking it. And if you go through the specific examples that Mr. Katsas has given, I think it's clear that jurisdiction furthers the goals of Congress in a way that striking it does not. Another example which he gave was that they intended for this court to hear claims rather than the district court. Clearly, striking jurisdiction will not further that basic objective of Congress. It will, in fact, return all of the claims to the district court. If the subject matter jurisdiction remains in this court, some claims will, in fact, be heard by this court, and they may be resolved. The other petitioners that are being heard today, the Uyghur petitioners, are a good example of this. In Parhat, this court resolved his claims in a DTA action, thereby avoiding the need for a more complicated and extensive habeas action. That's exactly consistent with Congress's objectives in enacting the DTA. The claim was heard by this court, it was heard in a streamlined fashion, and it avoided a more complicated and burdensome litigation in the district court. If you strike subject matter jurisdiction, then that objective is not met. If you retain it, then that objective may be met. And to the extent that there are issues regarding duplication of litigation, duplication of procedures, there are two points. One is that, given the course of this litigation, it is not clear that both the DTA and the habeas claims will be ready for hearing on the merits. At the same time, both litigations are on less than direct paths, to put it mildly. But it is the case, if there are such issues, those can be addressed by a court's inherent power to control its own docket on an individualized case-by-case basis. There's no need to strike a provision of a law to resolve those individualized issues. And it is vastly preferable for this court to resolve those issues that way rather than interfering with the will of Congress and striking an otherwise valid provision of a law.
In a severability analysis, is it appropriate for a court to consider fact that Congress has not acted?
I think given the history of this case, it is certainly appropriate here. If you look at the history of the DTA and the MCA, Congress acted with alacrity in response to court decisions regarding the legal rights of detainees at Guantanamo. Congress was more than on notice that after Boumediene, there were two causes of action available to detainees. Not only was it said explicitly by the Supreme Court, but the Attorney General called on Congress to repeal the cause of action under the DTA, and Mr. He gave a speech
that he actually sent legislation to Congress.
I don't know if the legislation was sent by him. Mr. Katsas appeared before the House Armed Services Committee and asked Congress on behalf of the Department of Justice to repeal the cause of action in the DTA. And in fact, identical bills were introduced in the House and the Senate to do just that, among other things. But Congress has not acted in the months since Boumediene, and under the decision in Medellin versus Texas this summer, the Supreme Court concluded that Congress's failure to act in the 4 months following a Supreme Court decision was evidence that Congress was not going to act. And I think
they referred also, I think, to the 4 years that had elapsed since the International Court of Justice decision.
That's true. I think that's actually
failed to act since then.
Well, I think that's actually perfectly analogous. Congress has been on notice since the DTA was being debated in 2005 that there was a possibility that the jurisdiction strip would be declared unconstitutional. For a period of time after Hamdan, there were, in fact, two causes of action available to detainees if they had filed a habeas case before that decision came down. So Congress has known for years that this was a possibility, and Congress has done nothing to make it explicit that two causes of action were viewed problematically by Congress. And so given that history, which continues to the current day, I think it is fair to infer that Congress, at least, is comfortable with the two causes of action going forward. The two causes of action are not duplicative. As the Supreme Court found in Hamdan, the DTA looks at the final decision of a CSRT and whether the Department of Defense complied with its own procedures. The habeas case does not necessarily do that. It is a more broad, obviously substantive consideration of whether or not there is a basis for a detention.
Why doesn't the habeas inquiry then encompass more potential? Provide more potential for the detainee than the CSRT review?
I think it does provide more potential for.
So, what is it about CSRT review that you get in addition that's of any value that wouldn't be more valuable? That would not make habeas more valuable?
Well, I think that there are two questions. One is, whether Congress intended the DTA to serve as a review of the CSRT process.
Yeah, but you just made a separate point,
not
about what Congress intended, but about the way these things relate to each other.
I think the answer is a timing one, and I think that, you know, given the course of the habeas litigation in the district court, just on Tuesday, the government sought reconsideration of the case management order Judge Hogan issued that covered a number of habeas cases. There is the hope that the DTA cases, because they were streamlined, because it was a more narrow cause of action, would proceed more quickly.
That hasn't happened,
but it may yet.
The habeas cases are proceeding considerably more expeditiously. I think there's a decision expected this week from Judge Leon.
I believe there's one today, Your Honor, right about now.
Okay, and that's been in a period of since June, right?
That's correct. I mean, it's not necessarily true, though, that all of the habeas cases are going to proceed that quickly. Many of them are covered by...
The hour if Judge Leon has his way.
Judge Leon only has a subset of the habeas.
They're all down in this district court here.
They're all in the district court here.
I think we can assume they're all going to move along as expeditiously as possible.
I would hope that...
But the DTA cases have been kicking around as we've tried to sort out this new statute, habeas being a much more familiar context for everyone.
There are
issues yet to be resolved under the DTA.
I think that's correct, but I don't think that is necessarily a reason.
Don't concede too quickly. I mean, the history of this Guantanamo litigation has been that the role of habeas and its scope has been hotly contested.
I was only conceding that the DTA cases have been kicking around for a long time. I think this panel knows that better than anyone, since my client had the first case.
And again, kicking around for a long time because aspects of it have been contested.
And aspects of the habeas cases continue to be contested by the government, a la...
What aspects?
Well, Judge Hogan issued a case management order, which would have moved the cases along at a very brisk pace. Including very short time frames for production of exculpatory evidence and a response on the traverse. On Tuesday, the government sought reconsideration of that case management order and, if necessary, an interlocutory appeal. That case management order covers the vast majority of habeas cases.
Has it been stayed?
It has not yet been stayed, no.
So it's moving right along.
Well, we'll see if it moves along.
What's the nature of the objections? I mean, habeas is a familiar context with now being applied in a somewhat new circumstance. Are these just factual issues?
I think that some of the objections are in classified declarations, which I'm not permitted to see. But to the extent I understand the information from what's available publicly, there are objections regarding burden and national security, similar to the objections that were raised in the context of the DTA litigation. But with respect, I think the question of whether or not the DTA or habeas is preferable to a detainee does not go to the question of whether or not retention of subject matter jurisdiction is consistent with Congress's basic objectives in enacting the statute. That may be...
But I think you raised the point.
I did.
Because it may reflect on that.
It may reflect on it, but I think that at base, this court's obligation is to consider whether or not retention of the cause of action in the DTA can further the basic objectives that Congress had in passing the law. And if you go through those objectives as articulated by the government, each one of them is better served by this court maintaining subject matter jurisdiction. In addition to which, I think as a preliminary matter, this issue has been resolved both by the Supreme Court in Boumediene and well-considered, well-reasoned dictum, and in the decision by the Parhat panel, by the panel of this court in Parhat, where they were quite explicit that both habeas and DTA causes of action are available to detainees after Boumediene.
Let me ask you, in a perfect world, if a detainee filed a habeas and it was promptly acted on by the district court and the decision made that the writ should not issue, then what would be left for the detainee?
I think that
have, as I understand the government's argument, the CSRT and a review going up, as I understand it, as far as the, I don't know if it's a special assistant or a deputy director of the Department of Defense who would have the final say on review. But there would be no judicial review, whether it's Article 1 or Article 3.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there would be no review, and the habeas case may or may not touch on whether the Department of Defense complied with its own procedures in conducting that CSRT. It might, but I can certainly envision a set of circumstances in which it would not. And if that were the case, then there would never be any judicial review of whether or not the Department of Defense complied with its own procedures in that CSRT. It's a question about which, given the declaration submitted in this case, there's a great deal of doubt.
And at least in the earlier filings, issues were raised as to conditions of confinement as well.
That's correct.
And we've sort of never gotten that far as to whether that's cognizable under what cause of action.
I believe that that issue is being litigated in the district court in connection with the habeas cases. But I don't think that we've addressed that issue in the context of the DTA cases, though. I'm not sure. There are many DTA cases pending, and I'm not sure about what's been raised in all of them.
Judge Rogers, further questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms.
Thank you very much.
Give you a few minutes for rebuttal, not repetition.
Thank you. On the question of careful dictum in Boumediene, the relevant statement in Boumediene was careful dictum, but it was in response to an argument that the CSRT procedures themselves violated the Fifth Amendment and that DTA review didn't cure the violation. It was not careful dictum in response to any severability issue. With respect to the point that the DTA and the MCA are different statutes, the DTA juxtaposes the habeas strip and the exclusive review scheme in immediately adjoining provisions. The MCA in Section 7 replaces the jurisdiction strip of the DTA with an expanded strip in direct response to Hamdan. In Section 9 of the MCA, the DTA amends military commission review procedures. In Section 10 of the DTA, Section 10 of the MCA, Congress amends the CSRT review scheme. The legislative history of the MCA makes clear, and the Supreme Court's decision in Boumediene makes clear, that Congress considered the statutes together, and it would be highly artificial to attempt to assess the MCA without reference to its DTA antecedent. With respect to Congress's failure to act, the issue in Medellin was whether an otherwise meritless stay application should be granted on the theory that Congress in the future might enact legislation to make the application meritorious. That has precious little to do with the question here, what inference one can draw from Congress's failure to act over a few month period. Finally, with respect to litigation burdens,
what is the status of the litigation of the legislation pending in Congress?
There was legislation introduced, I believe, by Senator Lieberman in response to Boumediene. One of many points of that legislation was to confirm that the DTA review provisions have fallen together with the habeas strip. If that legislation were enacted, that statute would pretermit the severability question before you today. But the failure to enact it, I don't think pretermits the question before you. Judge Ruck. It was introduced. There have not been any hearings. It's not as if Congress considered the issue and specifically rejected it. Finally, very quickly, with respect to litigation burdens, there are 220 approximately pending habeas actions. They are moving very quickly in district court. The government is under an obligation to file 50 factual returns a month. the Justice Department, the Defense Department, and the CIA together have 150 people working full-time on meeting our obligations to move those cases quickly. The question presented here is whether Congress would have wanted or whether this court should impose a burden to litigate approximately 160 DTA cases on top of the 220 habeas cases, whether viewed in gross or on a micro level from the perspective of any one defendant who can litigate in habeas. The answer to that question is no. Unless the court has...
What do you think Congress would have intended as to those detainees who have petitions pending?
DTA petitions pending? I think Congress would intend that they have their one constitutionally sufficient avenue for judicial review through the time-tested means of habeas corpus.
Well, but there's legislative history directly on that, isn't there, at the time of the DTA, where Congress was directly aware that these two proceedings would go forward?
No, I don't think so, because Congress, every time...
They debated, don't you remember, whether or not, what would happen to the petitions under the DTA that were outstanding. So, I mean, Congress was, it wasn't only that they knew because
but every,
petitions might come up, they directly debated that.
But every time they debated the question of the interplay between the habeas strip and the exclusive review scheme in this court, they conceived of the exclusive review scheme as a narrower, exclusive, to use a word in the statute, exclusive alternative to habeas, not as a complement to habeas or a discovery device to facilitate habeas. Unless the court has any further questions, I thank you for your attention and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Katsas. Ms. Cowan, thank you. Case is submitted.